Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a time in which we are facing literally deluges that are shaping part of our security situation as well as the lives of millions of Americans. It is a time in which we are facing other challenges, domestic and foreign. And who better to talk about all of this than our Dallas-based senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, Kevin Freeman, one of the country's preeminent experts on economic warfare, the author of a terrific blog entitled GlobalEconomicWarfare.com, and the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman, welcome back. It's so good to have you. Unfortunately, on a time and in a day in which we're watching our friends in the Houston area literally try to keep hope alive. Talk a little bit about what's happening down there, Kevin, at the moment, and what it means for our economic as well as national and homeland security.
Well, thanks, Frank. It's always good to speak with you. You know, it's a tragedy happening in South Texas, not just Houston, but kind of centered on Houston. But it occurs to me that this makes a point that you've made long for several years, that Mother Nature can unleash some pretty powerful economic forces against our nation, much as a solar flare could wipe out the electric grid, and you've warned of that. We're watching Mother Nature attacking a huge, maybe a quarter of our oil refining capacity that happens to exist in that area. Some 2.5 million barrels of oil a day are refined in the Houston area and turns into gasoline, and about a quarter of our gasoline comes from there. So the economic impact beyond just the human impact of displacing homes, destroying property, and so forth, the economic impact in the energy sector is quite serious.
And do you expect it to be enduring based on what is now, of course, we're still in the middle of this storm, I guess. It's premature to make any calculations. But from what you're seeing, from what you're hearing, reading about how the physical infrastructure of our energy facilities in the Houston area are faring, do you have a sense of whether this is going to be a condition that is going to be with us for quite some time?
Well, I have an optimistic sense of, you know, Texas is a resilient state and the people are resilient and the infrastructure we build is resilient. So my expectation is that we'll be able to get back online fairly soon. But you never know. Water damage is something that you don't necessarily see at first. And that's, we're getting so much water poured on these refineries. Now, the production that's in the Gulf, we've shuttered a portion of that, but some of that's already come back on stream. And the Gulf, you'd expect the oil platforms to be very resilient. They planned and prepared for hurricanes. What we don't know is the impact of the rains that could happen, you know, if it could slam and impact the Permian Basin at some point, depending on the way that the storm sits and where it goes. It does show how vulnerable we are, and it just the personnel issue, just have the people back to work. You know, even if the refineries stand, people that have been displaced from their homes, how do they get back in and do their jobs?
Amen. Kevin, you were kind enough to call attention to the work that we both have been doing for some time now, warning about electromagnetic pulse and other threats to our most critical of critical infrastructure, our electric grid. I'm interested that just last week there was a piece in WorldNet Daily about an exercise called EarthX that was undertaken by a terrific group called the Electric Infrastructure Security Council to try to really game out what they call a black sky catastrophe, whether it's a man-induced attack on that electric grid or the sort of Mother Nature terrible solar storm that could have a similar kind of deleterious effect. These are indeed things that we've got to be factoring in, thinking about, preparing against. Let me turn to another topic we're going to be discussing throughout the program, Kevin Freeman, have been doing so for some time and will, I'm sure, for the foreseeable future. And that is this phenomenon of the efforts being made by an unholy alliance of radical leftists on the one hand, like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League, and Islamists of various stripes, mostly under the influence, it seems, of the Muslim Brotherhood, to silence our free speech, in which we raise concerns about what one or both of them are up to. How do you see what's going on here, and in particular, as it's now manifesting itself in some of America's largest and most profitable companies?
Well, it's a very sophisticated effort, and the effort goes back. I think there was a catch on tape of Secretary Clinton talking to the Islamists. You know, we have this pesky thing called free speech, but we can shame people. And that was the methodology explained when you have a First Amendment, a pesky little First Amendment. The promise is, how do we get people to stop saying bad things about, jihad and radical Islamists and the imposition of Sharia law? Because if people talk about it, then they might try and stop it.
And by the way, this wasn't just an open mic. This was a speech that she made back in July of 2011, in which she talked about using old-fashioned techniques of peer pressure and shaming to get around the First Amendment. And some of that seems to be what's playing out at the moment, isn't it?
That's exactly what's playing out. And this methodology is very sophisticated. It's incorporated, well, we've got to tear down Fox News because Fox News was putting out contrary information. You know, it's, what a shame they're telling the truth on some of these things. So you go after the hosts of Fox News and you systematically attempt to remove them, which we've seen happen. We've seen attempts to buy up Hollywood. We've seen manipulations, for example, the Turkish government manipulating to stop the movie The Promise, which was a $100 million movie made with Christian Bale, and they did every effort they could to prevent it from happening. It told the story of the Armenian genocides, the story that the Turkish government didn't want out. We've seen the efforts that the SPLC is doing to brand hate groups. You know, on the one hand, they'll list a few pro-jihad organizations as a hate group, but then they call those that point them out as also hate groups. And that's where we're really seeing a problem, because they're raising enormous amounts of money. This is a group that doesn't apparently do much of anything other than point out the hate groups. They're raising enormous amounts of money, including a large donation from J.P. Morgan, for example, and Apple. And that's the easy thing for the corporate executive. Oh, I don't want to be labeled a hate person, so proving I'm not, I can make a small donation from Apple's perspective or J.P. Morgan Chase's perspective to this group. Well, that proves I'm not a hater. But that small amount of money is enormous when it's applied with the credibility that the SPLC is trying to claim.
Yeah, and it's not all that small. Let's be clear. It's a million here, a half million there. It's real money in terms of, as you say, trying to buy influence and silence people by smearing them. And Kevin Freeman, I guess one of the things that we'll be talking about shortly with Christine Brim is the way this is being institutionalized, with government's unanimous adoption by the United States Senate, for example, of a resolution that sort of leans us forward towards criminalizing hate speech or even hate intent. There's also, of course, what's happening in Europe, as we'll be discussing with her today. As you look at this, Kevin Freeman, is there any doubt in your mind that where this leads is a mutation beyond recognition and to our great detriment of our First Amendment freedoms?
Oh, that's the intention. It was telegraphed by Secretary Clinton. It's now being well funded. It's systematically being applied. We're seeing it even in officials inside the Trump administration who have been targeted because they hold contrary beliefs and they've been forced out. And we've seen CARE supporting officials that have stayed. So this is the plan, and we're watching it happen before our very eyes. The whole media effort to claim Antifa is acceptable and good, but the white supremacists are bad. No, they're both bad. They're both terrible, and they're both a violation of American principle.
And the president is being excoriated for making that point. We hope that he'll stand his ground, and we appreciate you doing the same. Kevin Freeman, as always, our hearts and prayers go out to the people of Houston and other parts of Texas. Thank you for reporting from a proximate area, and hope you'll stay well and come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll talk with Gordon Chang. We'll take stock with him of what's happening in Asia at the moment and what it might mean for you. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Gordon Chang, a man we have the privilege of talking with each week about matters in his portfolio, which is that huge part of the, well, the battlefront of the war for the free world known as Asia. He covers it exceptionally well at The Daily Beast, Forbes.com, World Affairs Journal, Fox News, and elsewhere. Of course, we like to think we're in that pantheon as well here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is also the author of two superb books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Very apropos of the topics of the day. Gordon, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So let's talk a little bit, Gordon, about the state of play between the United States and China as it relates to North Korea. You have several quite provocative pieces in Forbes.com, among other places, about the necessity, really, if we want to get the North Koreans' attention, if we want to actually have any kind of behavior modification, short of, I guess, regime change there, you have to go after some of the big companies, in particular big banks of China. Where are we with respect to the sort of thinking of the Trump administration with respect to all of that, and how is it sitting with the Chinese?
The Trump administration is still sending signals to Beijing about what it can do. So, for instance, on Tuesday, we saw the sanctions against 10 entities and 6 individuals, Chinese, Russian, and Singaporean. And that is just the most recent in a whole string of messages that Trump is trying to send to the Chinese. Before that, we had on June 29th, the unplugging of a small Chinese bank, the Bank of Dandong, for money laundering. And in the Obama administration, at the end of September of last year, there were the forfeitures of bank accounts. So there's a whole string of things that we're trying to send to the Chinese saying, look, the United States has overwhelming power over you. We are reluctant to use it, but we will. Now, the thing that the administration should do is it unplug a major Chinese bank, such as Bank of China, which was named in a 2016 UN report for devising and operating a money laundering scheme for the North Koreans in Singapore.
And Gordon Chang, when you say unplug, what does that mean mechanically and as a practical matter? And is it something that the Chinese are working to develop means of sort of finessing with their own arrangements, institutional and otherwise?
What I mean by that is designating a Chinese institution a primary money laundering concern under Section 311 of the Patriot Act. That would lead to U.S. correspondent banks no longer handling dollar transactions for that designated institution. This is what we did for Bank of Dandong on June 29th. And this means essentially that the bank so designated would not have access to dollars, which means it would be out of business everywhere around the world, except perhaps in China. So this is a death sentence on an institution. The United States has been unwilling to do that because there are obvious repercussions. But I make the point that the fact that there are repercussions on us, costs on us, is an argument to do it. Because if we were to show that we had political will, it would tell Beijing that we were serious about North Korea. And right now, the Chinese don't think that we're serious, despite all the bluster and the words, but this administration and previous ones.
This is a very important point, needless to say. And we were talking a moment ago with Kevin Freeman, who has been warning for some time, as have you, Gordon, I think, that the Chinese are taking steps to try to insulate themselves from such pressure by working into arrangements that will both reduce the preeminence of the dollar as the world's reserve currency and create their own sort of trading arrangements, financial trading arrangements and the like, that may enable them to be less dependent on the institutions that the United States largely put into place after World War II. Is that something to be concerned about here, or is this the moment to strike before those kinds of arrangements are in place in order to attenuate a present danger from North Korea?
No, the renminbi has been losing altitude in the global rankings of usage, largely because the Chinese have been making it even less convertible. Beijing has strict capital controls, and now they're actually applying informal controls that are not on the books. The reason is because they're trying to prevent capital outflow. So the renminbi is very weak right now in the sense that it's not advancing in global usage. You know, right now, the U.S. has overwhelming leverage over the Chinese, and there's no way they can actually insulate themselves from having Bank of China or another so-called Big Four bank being unplugged. What we could do, if we wanted to, is we could essentially bring down the Chinese financial system, which would bring down the Chinese economy, which would bring down the Chinese political system. Xi Jinping, the aggressive, belligerent, provocative Chinese ruler, he'd be out of a job, and he knows it. The only thing that keeps him in power is because we don't use our elements of national power, not only in this administration, but in previous ones.
Well, and Gordon Chang, if there were any need to reinforce the point that we had better be serious about North Korea, the past few days have seen still more ballistic missiles being rolled out, some tested. Initially, they were thought to be unsuccessfully tested, but apparently the Pentagon has reconsidered that. But at the very least, there are some new and potentially quite formidable long-range missiles that the North Koreans have been beavering away at, much to our surprise. As you look at it, Gordon, as our friends and allies in the region look at it, I assume that there is basically no alternative to a real and comprehensive challenge to what the North Koreans are up to.
Yes. Yeah, and the other thing is that the Trump administration has shown itself not up to confronting North Korea. So, for instance, we had Secretary of State Tillerson saying just I think last Tuesday, there hadn't been any North Korean missile launches since the UN sanctions that were imposed on August 5. Well, the North Koreans made him look a little bit premature by launching those three ballistic missiles. And also, President Trump, you know, at the time of Tillerson's comment said, oh, you know, Kim Jong-un, the North Korean ruler, is beginning to respect me. Well, I don't think so, President Trump, and I don't think so, Secretary of State Tillerson. The North Koreans just proved that they have no respect for the United States. And it's not because we don't have the power. We do, Frank. It's just that we're not using it, and we're making statements that are counterproductive to our own cause.
Well, I wish to say this were the only instance in which Rex Tillerson has been undermining President Trump. It isn't, as you know, Gordon, and it's vexing to say the least, especially given the stakes that are involved here, for sure. Let me turn quickly to one other issue that I know you've been following closely. Most of us have, frankly, probably not paid nearly enough attention to, and that has been the border crisis between China and India. There seems to have been a resolution of it. Is that your reading?
Well, there has been a temporary pullback by the Indian forces, and I believe by the Chinese forces as well. The statements from both Beijing and New Delhi are a little bit unclear, but at least the standoff appears to be cooling off right now. But this is only a temporary pullback on both sides. We know that the Chinese are going to continue to provoke India. And during the standoff in Doklam, which is in Bhutan, we saw the Chinese probe India on at least two other occasions. So Beijing is really attempting to test the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi. Modi has been willing to stand up to the Chinese, and good for him, because he's leading the way, showing the United States what a little bit of backbone can do. And we could certainly use that example, because we have not been willing to confront the Chinese like the Indians have been. So good for New Delhi. Let's learn from the Indians. It's about time that we confront the Chinese as well.
And of course, it comes at the moment that the president is talking about relying more on India rather than Pakistan in connection with the Afghan situation. Fascinating topics. Much more to discuss. We look forward to doing so with you next week. Gordon, thank you so much for your time today. Keep up the great work you do at The Daily Beast, Forbes, World Affairs Journal, Fox, and elsewhere, and come back to us again soon. Next up, we will speak with Christine Brim about developments that are a menace to our freedom of speech and much more. Right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined once again, I'm pleased to say, by a woman we visited briefly with last week about a problem of enormous concern, especially as we're watching more and more of the throes now in the United States, really across the country, of a debate about freedom of speech, one of our foundational cardinal rights under the Constitution of the United States. She is Christine Brim. She has worked with me and many of us in the cause of freedom for a long time, including as the Chief Operating Officer of the Center for Security Policy. These days, she is the founder and president of the Center for Policy Communications, and truly one of the go-to people when you're looking for insights into the sorts of challenges that we're facing from, among others, the jihadists and their enablers on the left. It's so good to have her back. Christine, welcome. Thanks so much for taking a few more minutes.
Frank, thank you so much for having me.
Well, again, the backdrop to what we want to talk about today is that there is inside the United States today a sort of cottage industry of the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League and various press outlets and corporations that are now pushing inexorably to restrict our freedom of speech, especially lest it offend anybody. What you have done some very important work doing is sort of connecting the dots between that domestic manifestation of this problem and what's taking place internationally. Would you talk a little bit about this organization, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe?
We have a meeting from September 11th to 22nd of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, founded in the early 70s. And this is an annual meeting which every year now for about the last decade has become an arena for a small group of U.S. associations, non-governmental organizations, to go and defend free speech against both the hard left European Union bureaucrats, but even more prominently against a range of Islamic associations who attend along with Islamic governments to try and impose hard criminalization codes, essentially Sharia blasphemy codes, against any criticism of Islam in any way, and criticism of Islamic doctrine. And they do this under the guise of trying to get a formal criminal definition of Islamophobia, which of course is a made-up term, encoded in these Organizations for Security and Cooperation in Europe recommendations, which then find themselves into actual EU regulations, into the regulations of the attending nation states, and into obligations that are international and are nominally non-binding. But under the Obama State Department, of course, they always tried to find non-binding regulations or agreements to be binding. Now see huge efforts between the Southern Poverty Law Center, Google, various socialist and communist party groups who attend with Antifa at all of these demonstrations. And we also have two parallel efforts to take the definition of what is a hate crime, both in the U.S. under the U.S. Senate resolution that was passed and another bill that's submitted both in the House and Senate, want to expand the definition of hate crime to include hate incident, which would not necessarily have a crime involved at all.
Now, what you've described, Christine, and there's so many dots here to connect, but you do a masterful job of doing it, is essentially a parallel system that is being established, that is being administered and fed by organizations that simply declare people, including folks like us, haters and bigots and racists. And you're describing a process whereby inexorably the plan, it seems, is to actually make those criminal activities, even something well short of speech or let alone a hate crime. Talk, if you would, Christine, about how this is already manifesting itself now in terms of, you mentioned Google and Facebook and Twitter and the like, conforming to European Union standards that that pretty much track with this First Amendment crushing approach.
Well, one of the best examples, I think, is that the Southern Poverty Law Center put great pressure under European law, which has also been, of course, the focus of the OSCE and will be the focus in September. And earlier this year, January, February, March, the Southern Poverty Law Center went up against a company called Cloudflare, which protects websites from cyber attacks. And there were 48 U.S. various websites, many of them were U.S., hosted in Europe. And so the SPLC pushed Cloudflare under European law to take these websites out and to get rid of them. And initially, Cloudflare did not respond, saying, well, no, they were a U.S. company and protected by the First Amendment. Subsequently, as we know, after Charlottesville and after the great hue and cry against free speech in all forms, Cloudflare then took at least one neo-Nazi group out and has apparently also deplatformed or ejected their protection from a number of other groups. And again, this is not to endorse, goodness knows, the views of some of these groups who I personally, and I'm sure we all disagree with, but nonetheless, our First Amendment does give them protection. However, European laws do not. And this OSCE meeting, which is held every fall in Warsaw, Poland, this is used as an opportunity by hard left EU bureaucrats, by US hard left organizations, and by Islamic groups internationally, and particularly from Turkey. It's used to keep inching and pushing forward inexorably this Islamophobia term with the broadest possible definition so that it can be applied in the greatest number of places at the same time that they're increasing the definition of what is a hate incident.
I want to just try to make sure that this dot is connected further. When you talk about Islamophobia, as you know so well, what this appears really to be a thin disguise for is imposing Sharia blasphemy restrictions on the Western world, the non-Muslim world, the Dar al-Harb, as it were. Is that basically what's going on here? And why is it that the left, in this country, the SPLC, the ADL, you know, the Googles and Facebooks and so on, as well as the left in Europe, would think that is a desirable thing, given what Sharia would imply for them and their favored minorities and priorities?
It's hard for me to see into their hearts. Let me say this. The left in Europe for many years has been hard left. There isn't a whole lot of moderate left when it comes to the concept of free speech. There are a few defenders. And the move in European law through multiple organizations has been to criminalize speech for a number of cases, against broad definitions of racism, against broad definitions of any kind of religious expression, to the point where very little can be said at this point in many countries, Germany, even the United Kingdom, online or offline, without facing criminal, not just civil, but criminal charges. And it is a consolidation of power. Criticism of Islam is something which there has been a great push of Saudi money, of Qatar money, to criminalize. A number of people in leadership positions have been happy to receive this kind of support. And as a result, we see a movement internationally to impose Sharia blasphemy laws in the name of limiting freedom of expression, limiting free speech, and limiting factual statements. Last year at the OSCE meeting, they openly stated that stating a fact could be seen by the law as hate speech. And indeed, they've now put people in jail for stating facts.
Christine Brim, as ever, you have rendered an incredibly important service by helping us see how these various developments relate to one another, and in particular, relate to what is happening now increasingly, obviously, in our own country. Thank you for this important contribution, as well as the work you're now doing at the Center for Policy Communications. I look forward to visiting with you again in the very near future. Next up, we'll talk with Janet Levy, intrepid blogger who has been chronicling, among other things, the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in the U.S. government. I can explain some of what Christine's just been talking about, that and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by a woman that I have admired for a long time but have not been in touch with for frightfully too long. She is Janet Levy, an MBA and Master of Social Work, who is an activist as well as a terrific and very prolific freelance journalist, with her contributions to such outlets as American Thinker, Pajamas Media, Front Page Magazine, Family Security Matters, Israel National News, and a blog that she runs at womenagainstsharia.com. It's great to have her with us. Janet, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Good to talk with you again.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I'm interested in something that you have been mulling and trying to expose for a long time, as have I. And that is the role that the Muslim Brotherhood, arguably the foremost Sharia supremacist organization in the world today, the spawning agent of so many others that we worry about because of their violent activities. But you've been writing, including recently, about a problem that I think is in some ways much more serious, and that is their presence in America, the Muslim Brotherhood, and even in our government. Talk a bit about both, you know, how we got to this point and the extent of the problem today.
Well, I just want to first say that the level of infiltration and subversion is alarming to a staggering degree, and the lack of knowledge in some quarters, breathtaking.
So if you look at the history of the Muslim Brotherhood's relationship with the United States government, how far back does it go, Janet Levy?
Well, you know, I can even go back to 1953, when a few dozen Muslim brothers were attending an Islamic conference at Princeton University, and they were invited by President Eisenhower into the Oval Office. And that even included Saeed Ramadan, and there's a picture online that that people can still access. Saeed Ramadan, the son-in-law of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna. So we go back that far. And then, you know, of course, in the 60s, early 60s, we have the beginning, the first chapter of the Muslim Student Association, which is the Muslim Brotherhood presence in the United States. Today we have over 800 chapters in universities and even in high schools now. So I think it was John Guandola who said that by the 1970s, there were Muslim Brotherhood front groups in every state in the United States.
And to the extent that they've spawned these front groups, they have, as I understand it, and by the way, there's an enormous wealth of information about all of this, folks, if you'd like to check it out at securefreedom.org, the Center for Security Policy's website, books there, including The Secret Plan of the Muslim Brotherhood, known as the Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in North America, are available as downloadable PDFs for free. But Janet Levy, what these books and our research and your copious writing on the subject makes pretty clear is that we have failed to learn over the years from the insights that we could glean from, for example, that secret plan that fell into our hands in 2004. We continue to allow Muslim Brotherhood operatives at the Council on American Islamic Relations and so many others to not only inform our government, but in some cases influence its policies and indeed even serve inside it. What are the implications of that as you see it? How does a country contend with the threat an organization like this and its ideology represent if they have such penetration?
Well, we're not doing a good job. As we can see from previous attempts at investigating some of this, they've been thwarted, shut down. I mean, I mentioned in my most recent article about Abel Danger. You know, this was an intelligence unit that identified 60 terrorists inside the United States prior to 9/11. That's 20 months prior to 9/11. They identified the Brooklyn cell that was headed by Mohammed Atta and three terrorists involved in 9/11, and they were shut down. And the information wasn't even allowed to be given to the 9/11 Commission. So we had a former member of Congress from the 7th District of Pennsylvania who had 19 years of service on the Armed Services Committee fight for their right to talk to Congress. We had 12 countries warn us prior to 9/11. So, no, it has really gotten us in a lot more trouble. Look at the Holy Land Foundation trial, the largest terrorism funding trial in our history. 40 boxes of evidence sequestered by the Department of Justice. I mean, we had members of Congress who wanted to look at that information. A few years ago, you know, you were involved in this effort. We had five members of Congress called the National Security Five who tried to call the country's attention to the fact that we had infiltrators throughout our national security apparatus at high levels with high-level security clearances.
And they were excoriated for their troubles, notably and in particular, of course, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. And very little was done indeed. Enormously frustrating. We're talking with Janet Levy, a freelance journalist who writes for, among other places, The American Thinker, PJ Media, and Front Page Magazine. And Janet, as you sort of take stock of this, we have the President of the United States announcing his intention to increase by at least some number the forces we have in Afghanistan. You mentioned John Guandolo, an extraordinary individual who has currently runs a program called Understanding the Threat. And he has, among others, warned that our eye is squarely off the ball if we're focused on what's happening in Afghanistan and perhaps simply perpetuating our activities there, which have proven pretty much in vain to this point, but ignoring what's happening in terms of this sort of Sharia supremacist program inside the United States. Do you share that concern? And if so, what should the average American citizen do to try to effect a course correction here?
Well, yeah, I definitely share their concern. I mean, we have what I've mentioned as far as the infiltration in every major organization in our country, not just the government, but we have infiltration in our schools and the military, our universities, corporations. We have extensive infiltration. But we have concerns here. We have terrorist groups right at home. I mentioned Jamaat al-Fukra that's not getting attention. I mean, the FBI had investigated them in the early 2000s, but this is a paramilitary group believed to have 2 to 3 dozen paramilitary compounds throughout the United States.
Organized by a fellow by the name of Sheikh Jilani, who claims that they're a state-of-the-art terrorist network. I couldn't agree with you more. That is a very troubling problem, and it is extraordinary.
And they're believed to have ties with al-Qaeda in Pakistan.
And be recruiting prison felons to their cause as they get out. There's so much more to talk about here, Janet Levy. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but I hope that you will come back to us soon, and thank you for the great work that you are doing through your own investigative reporting and the commentary that you provide at, again, places like PJ Media, Front Page Magazine, American Thinker, and Israel National News, as well as womenagainstsharia.com. Check it out, folks. And come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.